Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's probably in the memory hole by now. But it did happen this past week. There's just so much else that happened. You might have lost track of this. The Trump campaign put out or released an ad that featured replicas, simulations of newspaper headlines that would appear, supposedly, after Trump's re-election. And big headlines, but then there was smaller type on the pages, you know, as you would have on a newspaper front page. And one of the phrases that appeared in that text was, quote, unified Reich, unquote, the ch, and the rest of it. Unified Reich, as in, you know, the Third Reich, the Fourth Reich, however many Reichs you would like, or Reich. And, of course, it stirred up a momentary fuss. Fusses don't last that long these days because there's so many of them. The first explanation from the Trump campaign was that was, a staffer who just didn't see that text and just put it up. Now, I read the thing first when it came out. I saw that text right away. So maybe I should apply for a job as a Trump staffer. They could use me. But then as the week went on and other stories intervened, that one disappeared. So the unnamed staffer remained unnamed, and whatever disposition the campaign took with regard to that staffer remains unknown. There was literally no follow-up, except for CNN, which revealed at the end of the week that the whole thing started with a template from a Turkish digital designer who just threw in the language, you know, as demo, as filler. Here's what it would look like if we did this. And what it seems to prove at this point in time is that the more you screw up, the easier it is for people to forget every instance of it. That's a strategy. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hot, hot, hot.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you. Really, not just saying it. No, just saying it. Welcoming you to this edition of the show. Little news of our friend the Atom. Russia said the main power line supplying the Russian-controlled Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine was down for more than 3 hours this week. There was no threat to safety. Well, Russia says it. That's got to be true. This, of course, a continuing story of a power plant possibly running out of power. The 6 reactors at Zaporizhia, held by Russia and located close to the front line of the conflict in Ukraine, according to Reuters, are not in operation, but the plant relies on external power to keep its nuclear material cool and prevent a catastrophic accident. No, it can't do that by itself. The Russian management said on their official channel on the Telegram app that the reasons for the outage, which had not caused any change in radiation levels, were being investigated. The power line also went down for almost 5 hours in March, highlighting what the International Atomic Energy Agency says are, quote, ever-present dangers to nuclear safety, unquote, from the Russia-Ukraine war. The IAEA says that the plant has been experiencing major off-site problems with power ever since the conflict began, more than a couple of years ago, exacerbating the nuclear safety and security risks confronting the site, which, as I understand it, needed no exacerbation. And now, news of the smart world.
It's a smart world after all. It's a smart world after all. It's a smart world after all. It's a smart, smart world.
Microsoft's got something new for you. A feature in Windows called Recall. And it's attracting controversy even before getting out of preview. Windows Recall will remain in preview while Microsoft refines it based on user feedback or, says the Register Tech Journal, simply give up and pretend it never happened. The principle is simple. Windows takes a snapshot of a user's active screen every few seconds and dumps it to disk. The user can then scroll through the snapshots, and when something is selected, the user is given options to interact with the content. Microsoft says, quote, Recall will also enable you to open the snapshot in the original application in which it was created, assuming it still exists. And as Recall is refined over time, it'll open the actual source document, website, or email in a screenshot. This functionality will be improved during Recall's preview phase, unquote. Improvements, says the British Tech Journal Register, will certainly be needed, particularly in how the function deals with privacy. Windows Recall has the potential to be a privacy nightmare. According to Microsoft, all the processing takes place on a customer's device. The company also says that for the relatively small number of users running its Edge browser, has a market share of just under 13%, in-private sessions won't be stored, nor will DRM content. Recall, says Microsoft, does not perform content moderation. It will not hide information such as passwords or financial account numbers. That data may be in snapshots stored on your device, especially when sites do not follow standard internet protocols like cloaking password entry. Unquote. But a user can opt to filter out sites, right? No. Only if you're using Edge, Microsoft's own browser. To filter out a website from a snapshot, you must be using Microsoft Edge, says the company. Recall won't save any content from your private browsing activity when you're using Edge or a Chromium-based browser. unquote. And a developer and privacy expert at Vivaldi, which is a Chromium-based browser vendor, expressed hope that the automatic respecting of the in-private mode or incognito mode would apply outside of Edge. It almost certainly will not respect any browser's attempt to clear browsing data where the browser could historically have been in any screenshots, he said. It also cannot respect European GDPR privacy law requests to delete personal data exposed in an application where the source data is deleted by a data controller. And for this reason, it is clearly a massive privacy risk for any organization that handles private data, he says. Who knows what other private data or sensitive information it might store in a freely accessible format, he queries. The chief product officer of Mozilla says his company is concerned about recall. Quote, from a browser perspective, some data should be saved and some shouldn't. Recall stores not just browser history, but also data that users type into the browser with only very coarse control over what gets stored. While the data is stored in an encrypted format, this stored data represents a new vector of attack for cyber criminals and a new privacy worry for shared computers. Microsoft, he continues, is also once again playing gatekeeper, picking which browsers get to win and lose on Windows, favoring, of course, Microsoft Edge. Right now, there's no documentation, he continues, on how a non-Chromium-based third-party browser, such as Firefox, can protect user privacy from recall. Microsoft did not engage our cooperation on recall, but we would have loved for that to be the case, which would have enabled us to partner on giving users true agency over their privacy, regardless of the browser they choose. And AI expert Gary Marcus, a friend of this show, you've heard him here, was blunter. Quote, F that. I don't want my computer to spy on everything I ever do. Unquote. And the Office of the British Information Commissioner says, we expect organizations to be transparent with users about how their data is being used and only process personal data to the extent that it is necessary to achieve a specific purpose. Industry must consider data protection from the outset and rigorously assess and mitigate risks to people's rights and freedoms before bringing products to market, unquote. We'll let you know when they do that. New research has found that even though the dust clouds created by deep sea mining descend at a short distance for the most part, a small portion of the stirred up bottom material remains visible in seawater at long distances. This is from mining.com. These waters are normally crystal clear. So deep-sea mining could indeed have a major impact on deep-sea life, says marine geologist Sabine Halboom, who's studied this phenomenon. Halboom pointed out that deep-sea mining may take place at depths whose underwater life is yet to be described. Among other things, the silt at the bottom of the deep-sea, which will be stirred up when extracting manganese nodules, is a major concern. Since life in the deep sea is largely unidentified, clouding the water will create completely unknown effects. For her research, Halboom conducted experiments with different instruments to measure the amount and also the size of suspended particles in the water. At the bottom of the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, sure, you know about it. It's a vast area in the depths of the Pacific. She performed measurements with those instruments before and after a grid with 1,100 pounds of steel chains had been dragged across the bottom to disturb the silt. First thing that strikes you when you take measurements in that area, she says, is how unimaginably clear the water naturally is after we drag the chains back and forth over a third of a mile stretch. The vast majority of the stirred up material settled within just a few hundred meters. Yet we also saw that a small portion of the stirred up bottom material was still visible up to hundreds of meters from the test site and meters above the bottom. The water was a lot murkier than normal at long distances from the test site. In a follow-up study by somebody else, the dust clouds were visible up to 3 miles away from the test site. Companies competing for concessions to extract metals from the deep sea are seizing on the results of these initial trials of how low the impact of deep sea mining on bottom life can be. Yet that's not justifiable, says the co-promoter of Heilboom's research and an oceanographer at the Royal Netherlands Institute for Sea Research. Sure, he says, we know that the vast majority of the dust settles quickly, but when you take into consideration how clear these waters normally are, and the deep sea life depends on the very scarce food in the water, that last little bit could have a big impact. That news of the smart world, and an addendum about something else that's smart, self-driving cars. The LA Times, there's an LA Times, reports that GM's autonomous car company, Cruise, has reportedly agreed to pay an $8 to $12 million settlement to that woman who was hospitalized, you may recall, after getting dragged along the pavement by a self-driving taxi in San Francisco last year and made national news for half a second. The woman was a pedestrian, was struck by a hit-and-run vehicle near Market Street, thrown into the path of Cruise's self-driving car, which pinned her underneath, according to Cruise and actual authorities. The car dragged her about 20 feet as it tries to pull out of the roadway before fully coming to a stop. She sustained multiple traumatic injuries and was treated at the scene before being hospitalized. It's unclear when the settlement was reached or the exact amount. Sources familiar with the situation told Fortune and Bloomberg. The condition of the woman, whose name was not released, is unknown, but a representative of the hospital said she had been discharged. Cruise initially said its self-driving car braked aggressively to minimize impact, but later said the vehicle's software made a mistake in registering where it hit the woman. The car tried to pull over but continued to drive for 7 miles per hour for 20 feet with the woman still under the vehicle. The hearts of all Cruise employees continue to be with the pedestrian, and we hope for her continued recovery, Cruise said in a statement. Cruise halted its driverless operations after its autonomous taxi license was suspended by California's DMV. The company was also accused of lying to investigators and withholding footage of the car crash. Because, you know, the car takes pictures. It says it's going to start testing robo-taxis again in Arizona with a safety driver behind the wheel in case a human needs to take control of the vehicle. Quote, safety is the defining principle for everything we do, unquote. Cruise. Now, news of the godly. A Florida priest could face charges over an argument over communion. It resulted in allegations that he bit a woman. In a charging affidavit, police said the incident happened about 1:30 last Sunday. It's at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church. Police said they learned a woman had attended Mass at the church. She wanted to participate in her niece's communion. The priest conducting the service reportedly refused to give the woman communion bread, claiming she hadn't performed the necessary steps to be given the Holy Sacrament, the affidavit says. While the woman argued she had performed the necessary steps and was, quote, now accepted by God. The priest allegedly became upset, trying to ram a, quote, cookie, unquote, into her mouth, according to investigators. In response, the woman tried to grab another communion bread that the priest was holding, but he grabbed her and bit her arm, police said they were told. Police spoke with the priest, who explained he had previously told the woman steps necessary to receive communion. She refused to follow them. Quote, I gave her the benefit of the doubt. Did you confess between the Mass before and this? Because she can do it, he said. No, I don't need to explain to you. I don't need to have an explanation. You don't have the authority to judge me. I'm not judging you. I'm asking, did you confess? Unquote, the priest. He said the woman pushed him after he refused to give her communion, and she grabbed the tray of bread out of his hands, which is considered sacrilege. The Catholic faith considered the communion bread the body of Christ, and he was trying to protect it, according to the affidavit. Continuing to quote it, the priest advised that she pushed him and would not let go of the communion tray, and the only way he thought to extract her from it was to bite her arm, unquote. Priest stated he considered the event a matter of self-defense. The state will determine whether the priest will be charged with battery. The Diocese of Orlando, in a lengthy statement, says communion is not something a person can arbitrarily demand, and it is certainly not a mere cookie, as the complainant called it. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And one more item on artificial intelligence. OpenAI, the famous AI company, has reached another content agreement with a well-known mass media and publishing group that allows it to scrape that company's content. It's reached a multi-year agreement with Rupert Murdoch's News Corp.
Hey, Rupert, how you doing?
To bring news content to OpenAI. Financial terms were not disclosed. The AI pioneer has been busy lately, signaling similar content deals with others. Last week, OpenAI signed a content deal with the social media platform Reddit that would give it access to all user posts on Reddit. In the weeks prior, OpenAI had signed an agreement to license content from the Financial Times for the development of AI models. Also, with the German publisher Axel Springer and the AP. This comes after OpenAI has faced a number of lawsuits alleging unauthorized access to journalism content, including from the New York Times. The Times lawsuit did not include an exact monetary demand. It's reportedly seeking billions of dollars as compensation. The lawsuit cited several instances in which OpenAI and Microsoft chatbots gave users near-verbatim excerpts of Times articles. Shortly after the lawsuit was filed, the head of OpenAI, Sam Altman, expressed his surprise, saying OpenAI's artificial intelligence models don't need to train on New York Times data. Now News Corp and OpenAI have announced this multi-year agreement. Through this partnership, OpenAI has permission to display content from News Corp publications in response to user questions and to enhance its products. So, look forward in the future to Mr. Burns voicing the articles. It could happen. No, it couldn't. The partnership does not include access to content from any of News Corp's other businesses, aside from its so-called news publications. But here's a laugh. In addition to providing content, News Corp will share journalistic expertise with OpenAI. Says the chief executive of News Corp, quote, we believe an historic agreement will set new standards for veracity, for virtue, and for value in the digital age. Well, he was just looking for V's. We're delighted to have found principled partners in Sam Altman and his trusty, talented team who understand the commercial and social significance of journalists and journalism. This landmark accord, still quoting, is not an end, but the beginning of a beautiful friendship in which we are jointly committed to creating and delivering insight and integrity instantaneously, unquote, the chief executive of News Corp. And Altman of OpenAI gets equally flowery. Quote, together we're setting the foundation for a future where AI deeply respects, enhances, and upholds the standards of world-class journalism. Unfriggin' quote. Anderson?
I'm not gonna let you do this one. Sorry. It's so stupid. It's really so stupid.
To shed the life of before, to let my soul automatically soar, but I hit hard at the battle that's confronting me, yeah. Knock down all the roadblocks that's stumbling me, throw off all the shackles that are binding me down. Sew up the wounds of evolution, and it now starts to get in my way. So what if life's a revelation, if the mind speaks of only today? So real the pain of growing in soul, of climbing up to reality's goal, but I hit hard at the battle that's confronting me, yeah. So knock down all the roadblocks stumbling me, throw off all the shackles that are binding me. Starts at dawn, carries on to the season's ending. Long promised road flows to the source, gentle force, never ending. So hard to lift the jeweled scepter when the weight turns a smile to a frown. So hard to drink of passion nectar when the taste of life's holding me down. So hard to plant the seed of reform, to set my sights on defeating the storm. So I hit hard at the battle that's confronting me.
Thank you.
from New Orleans. This is the show. And now a little news of the Olympic movement. And it is a movement. I can feel it now. The L.A. County Board of Supervisors agreed this week to spend as much as $200,000 to hire a consultant to analyze the anticipated impact and opportunities associated with hosting the upcoming 2028 Olympic and Paralympic Games. This is in L.A. Of course, the Paris Olympics is this year. The board approved a motion directing the county CEO and the Department of Economic Opportunity to hire a consultant within 60 days and have an analysis completed 90 days after that. Man, that's service. The motion noted, the countywide economic and social impact on infrastructure, transportation, and security that comes with an influx of visitors from around the globe, or as Wolf Blitz would say, around the world, and asked for an assessment of the resources and planning needed to prepare the county for the games. The action directed the CEO to report back in 90 days on all potential impacts of the games on county services. The Olympics in L.A. have been designated as a no-build event, utilizing only existing sports and entertainment venues, but according to the motion, that designation excluded transportation issues. Efforts are already underway for completion of 28 transportation projects in time for the Olympics in 2028. I don't know why they're doing that. Getting around L.A. is so easy now. Quote, with car-free games in mind, we have to ensure our transportation systems are prepared for the increased demand, said one of the members of the board, calling for a unified legislative effort, not a unified Reich, to ensure state and federal transportation funding. The assessment is expected to include community impact, opportunities for local and small businesses, revenue generation, types of jobs that will be created, anticipated costs to unincorporated areas, and the evaluation of transit plans. One of the members called for a regional approach in preparing the report, working with county departments, private sector leaders, and contract partners to safeguard, quote, against the widely recognized threats of gentrification and displacement that comes with hosting the games, unquote. We'll keep an eye on that, won't we? And now news of the war.
Soft, listen to the war. We can listen to the war.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, see if you can detect any connection between the following three stories. First, half of Pakistan's pupils are going to be shut out of schools for a week as the nation takes crisis measures to lessen the effect of a series of heat waves, according to Agence France-Presse. Some 26 million students will be out of lessons from Saturday in Punjab, Pakistan's most populous province, which has ordered schools to close for the summer break a week early because of the soaring temperatures. Then there's this. An unprecedented third heat wave began this week in Mexico, where temperatures in the next 15 days are expected to reach the highest ever recorded in the country, according to researchers at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Guess that's a self-driving college. The National Meteorological Service announced this week the third heat wave will cause temperatures over 104 degrees in 26 of the 32 Mexican states and over 113 degrees in 13 of the states. Quote, a heat wave like this one is caused by persistent high pressure in a region between spring and autumn, more specifically due to anticyclonic circulation that is also known as a heat dome because it generates air downward and is associated with high humidity, according to a climate researcher at the Ensenada Center. Quote, heat waves are days, a couple of weeks, a month, but the long-term effect is drought. A heat wave impacts water, health, availability, thank you, Tom, energy use, and agriculture. Currently, 70% of Mexico is experiencing drought, 20% of which is deemed extreme by the National Water Commission. Mexico's dams are operating at a 23% deficit compared to the national average. And America's aging school buildings are on a collision course with a rapidly warming climate. Last fall, school officials were forced to send students home across the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, just as many were returning from summer break because of extreme heat and schools lacking air conditioning. Why, in my day, they all lacked air conditioning. In Baltimore and Detroit, high heat led to early dismissals, the same as it had 4 months earlier when summer temperatures struck in May. In Philadelphia last year, administrators moved the first day of school from late August to after Labor Day to avoid a repeat of heat-related school closures in previous years. The weather didn't cooperate. They ended up closing more than 70 schools 3 hours earlier than usual for the entire week, this report from the Washington Post. As the burning of fossil fuels heats the planet, it's delivering longer-lasting, more dangerous heat waves and higher average temperatures across much of the northern United States, where many schools were built without air conditioning. Districts are now forced to confront the academic and health risks posed by poorly cooled schools. Fixing the problem requires residents to pass multi-million-dollar school repair bonds, which can be hard to do. Climate change is arriving faster than most areas can adapt. Quote, we've had situations where it's been 88 degrees outside, but the real feel in the classrooms is well over 90 degrees because of the humidity, said the president of the Cleveland Teachers Union. Hello, Cleveland. Although most of the district schools have air conditioning, 11 switched to virtual instruction during a period of high heat a couple years ago. It's miserable, said Obrensky of the Cleveland Teachers Union. Students throwing up, not being able to keep their heads up, just horrible conditions, unquote. Because of the highly localized nature of U.S. public schools, data on school air conditioning is scarce. Researchers rely on surveys to gather information because they're so reliable. Yes, they're all about warm. And you heard it here. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
NYU, New York University, expressed its most sincere apology to the hundreds of graduates who waited in line outside Yankee Stadium for what dozens said to be over 2 hours during this year's commencement exercises in a Wednesday email sent to graduates, obtained by Washington Square News. The email signed by university administrators said NYU has, quote, continued conversations with Yankee Stadium to want to understand what happened, unquote, and encouraged students in the class of 2024 to share their feedback on the ceremony in a survey. Quote, we apologize to all of you whose entry was delayed and especially to those who grew so frustrated that they chose to leave, the administrators wrote in the email. Your experience was the opposite of what we planned for you, and we're deeply sorry about that, unquote. At the May 15th ceremony, hundreds of graduates crowded the entrance to Yankee Stadium over an hour after the commencement exercises were scheduled to begin, with dozens saying they were at the venue for nearly 3 hours before they were allowed in. The ceremony was postponed by around an hour, but the majority of the group could not enter until after the opening exercises had already begun. Hey, at least be grateful you graduated. Dateline Rathdrum, Idaho. A recent drama residency from the Missoula Children's Theater prompted Lakeland Joint School District in Idaho to apologize last week after some audience members complained that a staff member was transgender. Quote, this event was not intentional on our part. It's been identified as a weakness of vetting guest speakers or school assembly groups who are coming to our schools. I've already talked to the board about this. We love our students and never want to put them in uncomfortable or unsafe situations. Please accept my apologies, wrote the school superintendent Lisa Arnold on a social media post addressing the issue. The week-long theater program culminated with Atholl elementary students performing Treasure Island. The school superintendent said the kids who actually participated in the play had a great experience. The parents were very happy with everything. But some audience members complained, quote, we just had some parents that were frustrated. They didn't have all the information to make an informed decision, she said. Arnold later said vetting procedures would not change. Quote, we can't ask those things. That's illegal, unquote. OpenAI, in the news once again, thanks to Agence France-Presse, says its Sky artificial intelligence voice was made in collaboration with a professional actress and is not meant to sound like Scarlett Johansson. OpenAI chief Sam Altman apologized to Johansson after the movie star said she was shocked by new synthetic voice released by the ChatGPT maker. He insisted the voice was not based on hers. It was never intended to resemble hers, he said in a statement in response to controversy. Out of respect for Ms. Johansson, he continued, we have paused using Sky's voice in our products. We are sorry to Ms. Johansson that we didn't communicate better. The company added, regarding the voice actors they did hire, quote, to protect their privacy, we cannot share the names of our voice talents, unquote. And now, over to the case of Sean Diddy Combs, formerly Puff Daddy, soon to be Piss Duty. Sean Diddy Combs admitted that he beat his ex-girlfriend Cassie in a hotel hallway in 2016 after CNN released video of the attack, saying in a video apology he was, quote, truly sorry, unquote, and his actions were, quote, inexcusable, unquote. Going back to the quote, I take full responsibility for my actions in that video. I was disgusted then when I did it. I'm disgusted now, he says. Doesn't rhyme at all, does it? The security of video, which first aired Friday, shows Combs, wearing only a white towel, punching and kicking Cassie, an R&B singer who was his protege and longtime girlfriend at the time. Well, you got to get the attention of your protege. The footage also shows Combs shoving and dragging Cassie and throwing a vase in her direction. Maybe she liked flowers. Cassie, whose legal name is Cassandra Ventura, sued Combs in November over what she said was years of sexual, physical, and emotional abuse. The suit was settled the next day, but spurred intense scrutiny of Combs. Several more lawsuits were filed in the following months, along with a federal criminal sex trafficking investigation that led authorities to raid Combs' mansions in Los Angeles and Miami. He had denied the allegations in the lawsuits, but neither he nor his representatives had responded to the newly emerged video for a few days. Quote, it's so difficult to reflect on the darkest times in your life, but sometimes you got to do that. Unquote, Diddy on the video. He adds, quote, I went and I sought out professional help. I got into going to therapy, going to rehab. I had to ask God for his mercy and grace. I'm so sorry, but I'm committed to be a much better man each and every day. I'm not asking for forgiveness. I'm truly sorry, unquote. He looks somber, wears a T-shirt in the apology video, appears to be on a patio. It's his most direct response and first apology after 6 months of allegations that have threatened his reputation and career. Meredith Feiertag, who represents Cassie Ventura and other women who have sued Combs, said the apology was, quote, more about himself than the many people he hurt. When Cassie and multiple other women came forward, he denied everything and suggested his victims were looking for a payday. The lawyer continued that he was only compelled to apologize once his repeated denials were proven false, shows his pathetic desperation, and no one will be swayed by his disingenuous words, unquote. In December, after Ventura and at least three other women had filed lawsuits against him, Combs posted a statement on Instagram broadly denying the truth of all of them. Quote, let me be absolutely clear. I did not do any of the awful things being alleged, unquote. That post. The security camera video, dated March 5, 2016, closely resembles the description of an incident at an Intercontinental Hotel in the Century City area of Los Angeles described in Ventura's lawsuit. The suit alleges that Combs paid the hotel $50,000 for the security video immediately after the incident. Neither he nor his representatives have addressed that specific allegation. The suit said Ventura had been trying to get away from a sleeping Combs who had already punched her in the face before the video began. Combs is not in danger of being criminally prosecuted for the beating. The statutes of limitations for the assault and battery charges would be likely to have expired years ago. Dateline Kalamazoo, Michigan. I just wanted to say that. No, it's a story from Kalamazoo. A new report is aiming to shed light on alleged abuse cases that reportedly took place within the Diocese of Kalamazoo, released by Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel this week. The report contains detailed descriptions of sexual abuse allegations and other sexual misconduct, including grooming and misuse of authority against minors and adults, according to the Department of the Attorney General. Among the findings were the names of 19 priests, 12 of which are priests for the Diocese of Kalamazoo, 7 others who ministered in the diocese. 12 are accused of abusing minors, 5 are accused of misconduct with adults, 2 others are accused of misconduct with both adults and minors. Well, that's only fair. Today, we are confronted with a disturbing truth, Bishop Edward M. Lowes said. The sexual abuse of minors by priests here in the 9 counties of the Diocese of Kalamazoo is an historical reality. It is tragic, appalling, and inexcusable. No one knows better this than you who are the victim survivors of that abuse. You were entrusted to our care. We feel to protect you. There is no other way to put it. For that failure, I am deeply sorry. Unquote. The bishop. And one could only assume he wasn't speaking only for himself, but for the bishopric. Dateline London, the former chief executive of Britain's post office, Pamela Vennells, on Wednesday apologized for the scandal that led to the wrongful prosecution of hundreds of sub-postmasters who ran the local branches. Post office took 700 people to court between 1999 and 2015 based on faulty evidence resulting from central IT system failures. Another 283 people were prosecuted by other bodies based on the errors of the same system. More than 200 of the total were sent to prison, and in some cases, victims died before they were exonerated. Quote, I would just like to say how sorry I am for all that sub-postmasters and their families and others have suffered as a result of all the matters that the inquiry has been looking into for so long, Vennells said this week after a government inquiry hearing. Her first public comments in nearly a decade came at the start of a 3-day testimony in which Vennells was being questioned by lawyers as part of a wider government inquiry. Questions remain over what Venables and other executives knew, all while the post office continued to push for sub-postmaster prosecutions. Focus is also on the myriad of issues with accounting software that were made by Fujitsu. At one point, Venables broke down in tears while discussing the case of Martin Griffiths, who took his own life while being pursued by the post office for an alleged shortfall of $76,000. The post office is a state-owned company in Britain. Questions have also been raised about the government's role in the scandal, which has been described as one of the most widespread miscarriages of justice in British history. As early as 2009, a trade publication, Computer Weekly, published an investigation detailing serious issues with Fujitsu's Horizon software. For more than a decade, hundreds of sub-postmasters had complained to the post office that the software was generating unexplained shortfalls in their accounts. Most were told they were the only ones experiencing issues. Some sub-postmasters were sent to prison. Others spent tens of thousands of pounds covering the shortfalls with their own money or had their contracts terminated. Venables this week specifically apologized to Alan Bates, who led a years-long public and legal effort for justice for 555 post office victims, and to Lord James Arbuthnot, a member of the UK's House of Lords, who was also involved in the campaign. I and those I worked with made their work so much harder, Venables said. During a testimony, she also apologized for comments she made in 2012. Then, when she told British politicians that the post office had been successful in every case it had taken in relation to the software. That was not true, but she didn't know it at the time. If only people spoke about stuff they knew and really believed, it'd be a much quieter world. And UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak apologized wholeheartedly to every victim of the country's infected blood scandal after the final report of an inquiry into contaminated blood transfusions was released this week. He cited the report's conclusions that British authorities, including successive governments and the National Health Service, were guilty of a catalogue of failures amid a pervasive cover-up over the decades. The chair of the inquiry said the disaster was not an accident. He called for a compensation scheme to be implemented within a year. Between the 1970s and 80s, more than 30,000 British people were infected with HIV and hepatitis C after they were given contaminated blood treatments and transfusions. Approximately 3,000 died. As a result, many more continue to suffer from common and chronic health problems and stigma. The inquiry examined over 50 years of decision-making procedures before, during, and after the infection of these 30,000 people and asked why men, women, and children in the UK were given infected blood and/or infected blood products, how the authorities, including government, responded, the nature of any support provided following infections, and whether there was a cover-up. The chief of the inquiry outlined the unacceptable levels of risk and complacency on the part of authorities. Blood products continue to be imported, both domestically and from abroad, from high-risk donors, including from prisons in the UK and right here in the good old USA, where prisoners and drug addicts had been paid to give blood. Licensing authorities failed to recognize that these blood products were unsafe, and governments delayed introducing universal screening of blood donations for HIV. Despite it being urgent, it was a public emergency to begin this, according to the commission. The risks had been known since 1982. It took until the end of 1985 to use heat treating used to eliminate the HIV virus in blood donations. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the show. Back next week, same time, same radio station, or on your audio device of choice, whenever the feeling strikes you. I'll be here, nonetheless, helping to build that unified Reich we all dream of. The email address for this broadcast, your chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts, here's a bit of history, and so much more to read, hear, and ponder, all at harryshearer.com. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego desk, to Pam Halstead, and to Thomas Walsh at WWNO New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. So long from the Crescent City.